Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're speaking with Laura Dalrymple and Grant Hilliard from Feather and Bone Providor in Marrickville about their new book, The Ethical Omnivore, Whole Animal Butchery, Regenerative Agriculture and the Role Animals Play in a Sustainable Food System. Okay, welcome to another Food Fight podcast. My name's Steph Bosch-Duma with my co-host here, Simon Evans.
Hello.
And we are sitting here in Marrickville upstairs at Feather and Bone Providor, joined by Laura Dalrymple and Grant Hilliard. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We start our podcast with an acknowledgement of country. So we would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather today and talk, and pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. Okay. Feather and Bone. Some people may have heard of it. Some people may have eaten the meat that you produce out of here in the past. And you've just released this beautiful cookbook called The Ethical Omnivore, which we will get to. But for people who don't know, Laura, we'll start with you. Do you want to give us a bit of a background on Feather and Bone? Because there is so much to this business and you address so many important issues in the business and in the book. So it's worth explaining to get started.
Do you want, so what Feather and Bone is?
Let's start there.
I'm a bit nervous about saying this in front of Grant because he might not agree.
Grant, feel free to jump in.
Yeah, yeah.
So really I suppose our business is organised around the idea of creating a transparent line of sight from the producer to the consumer and back again. Our objective is to provide viable options for people who are looking to purchase food that's raised in systems which are benign and which grow fertility and resilience and build community. It's been interesting actually because the Ethical Omnivore, which is the name of our book, it's a little bit contentious, and I guess the explanation of what an ethical omnivore is also central to what we're doing as a business, because what we're trying to do is support producers and consumers who want to buy food that is grown in ways which align with their value systems, with their ethics. So we see that the conventional or contemporary food landscape is riddled with problems. It's a bit of a minefield, and most contemporary agriculture has more in common with mining than it does with ideas of traditional food production. And so our goal and our job is to find farmers who are doing really wonderful work in building fertility and resilience and vibrant ecosystems, and promote their work to consumers who are looking for better options.
Mm. Okay, and Grant,
correct.
Neither of you agreed.
There's a lot more to it. I mean, that's a very good essence. That's a good pricey. I mean, it's a good starting point.
Yeah.
But go on.
Okay. So neither of you are butchers by trade. Neither of you have a background in butchery. And I just want to get an idea of where was the initiation of this journey towards, maybe conscious food consumption in your own life, and then I guess what must amount to an obsession to carry that over into a brand new business in an industry that you've not worked in before.
Complete ignorance is remarkably protective, at some level. And I think that would explain the early days. I worked in restaurants and was a sommelier in restaurants through sourcing wine, I became very interested in the way it was produced as much as the wine itself. I was very interested in the viticulture. And it's only through visiting a vineyard that you really sort of locate the wine. And that sort of seems to be a reasonably accepted idea when it comes to wine. But it certainly wasn't really thought about when it came to the proteins, the main proteins that we were sourcing in the restaurant. So I sort of was getting oil and garlic and various other products that we're using, mostly at Sean's Panorama. I've worked there for 9 years.
Yep.
And Sean was unusual in that he mostly cooked on the bone and then carved off it after he had cooked it, which was still very unusual, actually. But in terms of rewarding flavour and the experience for the diner, there was an extremely strong sort of response to that, it seemed to me. So he gave me the freedom to be able to source things and would welcome them into the restaurant. And that started with a rare breed lambs or older breeds of lamb, which weren't differentiated. They were still, beef was starting to be differentiated a bit, and certainly obviously fish species, but lamb just came as the most you would find would be it was milk fed or possibly organic. They were the only really sort of just differentiations between lamb, but nothing about breed, which I thought was sort of bizarre, really. So a chance listening to a program on Radio National, and one of the people being interviewed said that if you haven't had Southdown lamb, you haven't lived. And I sort of thought that Southdown lamb, that sounds sort of interesting, and did a bit of research on it, and it turns out that they're sort of the progenitors of all Southern English lamb. Black Suffolk and everything that we presume that we have now is more or less has come from Southdown. And I was curious as to why they weren't around and why you couldn't buy them, and that sort of took about 6 months to find someone who would sell me three. And
he was a breeder,
an obstetrician and a breeder, and it was a sideline for him. But I wasn't planning to butcher them. I was just planning to sell them whole to restaurants. So three chefs bought three different lambs, and it was a curiosity, really. I wasn't really making any claims for it, and I was sort of open to whether it would be any better or worse. It was more just to sort of say, well, what's the difference between these lambs and others? And it turns out Southdown are very fine textured. They're beautiful leading lambs, and very hard to come by these days, especially in New South Wales. There's more in Victoria still, but
they're pretty hardy too, aren't they?
Oh yeah, they're very unattractive sheep, actually.
Yeah, they look like bulldogs.
Yeah, they're sort of very broad.
There's no such thing in Wales.
Well, that's interesting because they're also still sort of remnant in New Zealand as well, and that would be... so, anyway, they were good, and it one thing led to another, and so I was able to buy a few more. And then someone said, oh, you might be interested in some pigs. And I was, an organic pig grower down in the Snowy Mountains. And they were small, so I didn't have to break those up. But eventually people wanted parts of them, and that forced me into the position of having to learn how to break them down.
And there was no business plan. It was entirely organic.
Yeah, but at what point, so like it sounds like the interest was initially in finding rarer breeds and in providing quality to chefs and something different to chefs and stuff. Where did the path go towards sustainability and regenerative agriculture and ethical consumption?
That grew, I think. It was always an interest, and I was you know, particularly interested if I could get organic certified meat or garlic or whatever for the restaurant at that stage. But it's grown over the 15 years we've been doing this, really.
Just to interrupt quickly, I think it's also fair to say that the farms from which Grant was originally sourcing, the farmers who were interested and curious and adventurous enough to be growing these unusual breeds, if you like, those people were not growing largely weren't growing according to conventional standards. They, you know, these animals were grown outside, slow growing heritage breeds, for example, grown outside. They weren't grown in sheds. So from the beginning, although it may not have been, you know, the driving initially articulated as the driving force, nothing that Grant ever bought at the beginning, or that, you know, we bought together when I joined, has come out of systems of agriculture which we don't endorse, from a humane sort of animal livestock perspective, or from an environmental, you know, welfare perspective.
I think there is just a link with quality produce and that type of farming.
Of course.
So I imagine that just came around very naturally, of when you're trying to find higher quality things, you're looking for people who are passionate, who are into it, and then that would have naturally led them to these regenerative practices and organics and things like that, because it does have a link to quality.
That's the happy coincidence. Yeah. It was sort of important to me that we didn't say that this meat was quality meat or best quality meat, which was what everybody pretty much says about what they sell.
Yeah.
the distinction, and it's sort of a nuanced one, is that what we sell embodies a series of qualities, and those qualities are the genetics of the animal, the way it's grown, the people who look after it, the way they manage themselves, and the people who are employed in the management of those animals, the slaughter, obviously, the way they're transported, and then what we do with them finally. So those qualities, if they are well chosen and the correct decisions have been made, I don't have to worry about the quality of the meat. It looks after itself. And so chefs, I have total respect for them, don't get me wrong, but they start mostly from the wrong end. And the valorization of chefs is all about what they've done to transform this humble ingredient into something wonderful. And I see it sort of completely the reverse. I see it as they're the end of the line and a very privileged receiver of a set of decisions that have been made by many other people before it got to them. And the chefs we work with now, I think, put themselves in that position, which is a fairly humble position in relation to the produce. They don't see themselves as magical transformers. And I think, you know, working at Sean's, that, you know, his food is deceptively simple, but there's a high level of craft behind it.
Yeah.
But he's not flashy in the way he does stuff. So
I guess just a maturation of chefs in general is, I think, people who, when they get to cooking sort of the better food, is when they learn to do less and way to just handle ingredients in a manner that shows off the way they've been produced, right, rather than trying to completely change them or doing this, that, and the other, and you know, completely altering what someone spent a lot of time doing.
That's really interesting, because the regenerative farmers we meet and with whom we work also, you know, the sort of the fundamental idea is to get out of the way of nature.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because nature is far superior at organizing and managing systems and so on. And so really the farmer's job is to do the best they can to get out of the way and let that self-organizing principle exist. And to a certain degree, I suppose you could say that's similar with chefs.
Same with kind of wine as well. The better wines are the ones that come from good grapes and have been handled gently and then let to do, you know, what they do.
Yeah.
I think it's that, and such interest in the link you made from the way that the Somms love going to a vineyard, love looking at, you know, a place and terroir. But chefs are a lot more adverse to actually doing that in their spare time.
Well, it sort of doesn't occur to them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny,
yeah.
You know,
can't
like,
keep
why
a song away from the vineyard.
You?
They love it.
Yeah, that's it. I'm curious as to why it is that chefs don't have the same drive.
I think it might be something to access. I think vineyards are a lot more open.
I just reckon, from my experience, it's just schedule. It just seems to be that every chef that I've worked with when I've worked in hospitality has been like, I'd love to take this team to a number of producers and things like that. And in the whatever 10, 15, however many years I spent in hospitality, I did that once with a team.
Yeah.
And that was before a new restaurant opening where we were going, had the time. But then once the wheels are in motion and everyone's got their roster and all that sort of stuff, to find a way to get couple of days to go and visit producers is tough.
Before Tom and I bought
Cabot. So you do have to make it a priority.
I know you're right. Look, I mean, even in our business, we struggle to get our employees to farms. Mm. It is hard.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, but the couple of years running up to before Tom and I bought Caveau, we were going out to see a lot more people than when we actually owned the place and could actually use the produce. And then it was kind of a lot more of...
You could argue, though, that it's something that actually, you know, there's an opportunity now, potentially, with what's happened with the pandemic, to actually rethink some of the ways that we do business.
I mean,
everybody's rethinking across the board in all sorts of industries. Maybe this is also something that needs to be reconsidered. Maybe, you know, businesses close for a day or two and you know, that education and that connection is actually something that consumers will value enough to subsidize.
Mm. Yeah. You know? I mean, I think it's that understanding can increase quality. And I think
that's it.
You know, when it might be a position where there's, you know, limited resources about and you're really fighting for people's attention and people's money, then those little 1-2% can make a difference to your business. Mm. If that's the difference between customers coming to you because you have this education and this knowledge and that behind you, that, you know, that can make the difference.
Mm. I think that one of the things that I noticed as well was in the trip that I just mentioned, Moreland's was one of the places that we visited. Taking front of house staff to farms as well was in terms of the return on investment you get from...
We're talking about all staff. We're not just talking about chefs.
Not just about chefs.
No, not at all.
Because when they're invested in what they're selling you and they can tell you about the farm or whatever it might be, the service quality is just... The bar is just raised so much at that point. Okay. Let's go back to... We're still sort of in the beginnings of Feather and Bone a little bit, and you mentioned, Laura, about how there was no business plan to start with, really. Not at all. Grant says not at all. There must have been a point where you thought, we're onto something here. And was there a moment, and what might have been the trigger that gave you the confidence to say, let's do this, like we're gonna have a real crack at it? Like,
I think we probably both have different answers to that.
Yeah.
You answer.
I thought early on that that the response to the idea was always extremely positive, and often those initial gut reactions are really important. I'd sort of been involved in various projects, art projects and film projects, where long-winded descriptions of things, you can see them sort of initially, they might be engaged and then
the eyes glaze over.
Well, you know, they're struggling to follow you. They got this really quite quickly. There was more of an emphasis then on breed, and probably at the expense of, and it goes to the heart of your question before, which is when did it sort of start to become the focus on what's below the ground rather than what's above the ground. But even at the early stages when we're articulating about sourcing what was above the ground, there was a very quick and direct sort of response, which was, I knew from selling in restaurants and being on the floor that was a powerful, you know, a powerful response, and that would carry it a long way. And I didn't quite know what form it would take, really. And learning to butcher was a very steep learning curve.
Mm. So I guess like a lot of businesses, like, you know, my publishing and maybe some of what you've done, Simon, and stuff, it's sort of a feeling around public response and around the conversations that you have, that there's enough people that seem interested in what I'm talking about doing that just got to give it a go at some point.
Yeah, yeah. There's always a risk, especially a lot of time if you bring an idea to people, most people say, that's a great idea, you should do it. And I think a lot of like bars and restaurants get that quite a lot. They'll have like someone who's not really in the industry, have a lot of friends who say like, oh, you make great cocktails, or your cooking's great, you should start a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
And they dive into it, and then suddenly their friends turn up for the opening party and never again. So there's definitely a leap of faith when with an idea like that, that you're like, well, I think this might be the case. Maybe we can turn it into an ongoing business, but it's still quite a jump, and you have to be
quite supremely confident. And I think,
running it side by side with still working in restaurants, so yeah. I didn't actually have to say, "Oh, well, I'm just going to go and do this thing now," which made the landing much softer than it might have otherwise been. Mm. And Sean was tremendously supportive in buying a lot of the produce that I was sourcing when I started. So I was able to drop shifts slowly as I increased what I was selling.
Sorry, Laura. Just a quick tidbit. When you bought those first three lambs, was it lambs?
Yeah, yeah. Lambs, yeah.
Where did you put them?
good question. They went to the organic butcher in Bondi Road.
Okay.
He agreed to put them in his cool room.
Okay.
But, this is the other sort of aspect of it. There was only $300 in the business, so it bought three lambs. So it wasn't like a... That was what was risked. There was no capital. Anyway, and I didn't have a refrigerated van, so... they were delivered in the back of my Corolla.
Love it.
And I think I went to Bird Cow Fish and I sort of got there and then thought, shit, I need something for the lamb. And I had a yoga blanket in the car, which sort of served the purpose. And Alex Herbert said, classy.
Yeah.
I sort of had to get past that quickly. And I did find a refrigerated van.
Eventually, that's good.
Eventually, yes.
Yeah, cool.
There were some rather unconventional and interesting methods used at the outset, well, I can assure you. Some of which we can't talk about, which people would think, who the fuck are these people?
Yeah, I mean, you get to a certain point and you need to do it properly. Yeah, and, okay. And for good reason, you know. They were never endangered, but it's less than ideal.
No, of course. Yeah. Love those old stories, though.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, though, you were saying how, you know, when did you think this is something worth pursuing? I wasn't involved at the outset. This was Grant's idea and Grant's business. I was sort of cheering from the sidelines, but I wasn't actually involved. And our lives were quite complicated because Grant was had been working at the restaurant, but he was also the primary carer for our kids because I was working full time, and we have three sons. So, I think at that stage, initially only two when the business started, but then we had another one. So things were quite complicated. But for me, the thing, apart from thinking that it looked and sounded great and seeing how people responded to the idea, as Grant said, I got to a point in my own career and my own life where I felt that I was really looking for more meaning, I think. I'd been involved in work where I felt that maybe I was able to change things from the inside, you know, within businesses. But that started to wear me down because I didn't feel like I was making progress. And I looked at what Grant did and I thought, what he's doing is really, really cool. And it ticks every box for me in terms of my ethics and my belief system, what I care about. And it's business with purpose, or it's activity with purpose and with real capacity to make tangible change. And long story short, I left my job and I got involved and I started to help Grant. At that stage, it was a shopping bag full of receipts and some invoice books. So my job was to try the retail side
of the business.
Yeah, that's right. And then it was the other thing too, is that people were starting to say, well, I had that at the restaurant or at such and such a restaurant. How can I get this for my home? So then I started working on the retail business. But it was really that moment where I looked at what Grant was doing and I thought, that has meaning and purpose and that makes sense. And I think that that is the thing that people look for, and I think that we find now, even still, people who come to us, and it's other people who have businesses like ours, they're looking for something and they're looking for that sense of purpose and that sense of alignment with their value system and the way that they behave in the world, the way they spend their money, the way they cook, the way they, you know, consume. And, so for me, it was realizing that what that meant for me personally, that really catapulted me sort of into a different way of living my life and haven't looked back, you know.
Great. I imagine quite good timing as well with the customers wanting that level of detail and ethics and you know, the whole food and drinks industry has been going more and more that way. So I think this is quite good timing to start that business with that kind of upturn.
Well, there was sort of there was remarkably. I mean, it's hard to remember. How like that 14 years ago is pre-social media.
Mm.
So people's contact with farms was really. They had no direct contact with farms. The Kania farmers now are able to Instagram constantly and post, and you know that's a real presence in people's
it's
lives. But before that, I mean, there wasn't anything, and so it, you know, you can sort of forget just how sort of disconnected we were from those things. But the demand was certainly there, and it was a. It, we were still seen as highly marginal, where now I think we're sort of seen more or less as mainstream.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, far out. It is amazing to think how much it's changed. Mm. And one of the things is now the dining public recognising producers when they see them on menus or see them on Instagram posts, and they go, oh, well, I love that lamb or pork or fish or whatever it might be. Mm. In a time that you're talking about, Grant, I mean, only chefs and people in the industry would know who a producer would be.
And farmers couldn't connect with each other either. So we had this experience where we were working with people who were mavericks in the field, and they, you know, it was really hard for them because they couldn't necessarily communicate and network as well with other like-minded people. It was harder. So, I mean...
Share knowledge and stuff is so important.
It's just been brilliant. It's just been an explosion in capacity. It's wonderful.
All of those people, you know, there's not a farmer that we've worked with that hasn't, and this is still the case, sort of sadly, there's not a farmer that we've worked with, and that's probably about 60 to 70, I'm not sure of the exact number, whose immediate neighbour is highly sympathetic or wants to copy what they do.
Mm.
Even though they can see the productivity rewards, they can see the benefits directly, they still don't do the same thing. So that doesn't seem like much, but in sparsely populated rural areas, that bespeaks social isolation.
Mm.
Mm.
There's that guy in the pub who's that freaky grower who, you know, who doesn't have many cattle on his farm. He's got this huge farm and not many on them, but he feeds them all the way through the drought.
Mm.
And doesn't have a feed bill that cripples them for years to come. And so that is changing too, simply because economics are forcing a lot of farmers to reevaluate the way they farm. Mm. They're losing land to salination, they're losing land to, you know, degraded fertility. So they know that the productivity is declining. And so people are being brought to the table now to have a discussion that they wouldn't have had 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And of course the drought brought that home in very sharp relief. The people who were farming in different ways survived that drought and came out of that drought and are still coming out of the drought in a much better shape than people who sort of flogged the place. Mm. And I mean, the North Coast, you know, up around New England, still technically in drought.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, we forget that, especially on a day like today where it's raining cats and dogs, you know, you think...
Flooding everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. But actually, you know, that's not... And and as Grant points out, for a lot of people who perhaps haven't been... were managing their farms in ways which were perhaps more focused on short-term gain as opposed to long-term gain, when those rains do come, you know, they don't necessarily soak in because those soils... don't have the capacity. Mm. They're not spongy,
We'll get to soil health in a second. I'll pause you there, Laura, before we get to soil health, because it's something that's really important to talk about, because I think it's a massive, massive issue that people just don't have on their radars in general. Mm. Quickly, we'll talk a little bit about how Feather and Bone incorporates all of these values into the business. I think that... it's a good idea to give people an understanding of why whole animal butchery is important and what it does in terms of sustainability. So, Laura, for people, you know, who don't understand the difference and don't understand what the benefits are, do you want to give us an overview?
Sure. So from our perspective, as you've just heard Grant describe in the story of how he started the business, it was sort of whole animals or nothing.
Mm.
So we started... probably somewhat ignorantly working with whole animals because it was just what was in front of us. You know, that was the option that was presented to us. You can buy this whole animal. You know, Grant bought it, sold it to the chefs that way, sold it to chefs who were able to negotiate a whole animal. And as you would know, not that many chefs can negotiate a whole animal.
Tough.
That's another thing.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
we used to buy a couple of whole cows, and it was a lot of creativity and a lot of staff lunches to use a lot of
skill levels and all that sort of thing. So I think from the outset we started without a specific focus on the idea of whole animal, but. There were a couple of factors which played into that as well, one of which, for example, was that farmers we were working with didn't have an economic framework which allowed them, or a logistical framework which allowed them to sell us parts of an animal. So if we wanted to buy from those farmers, we had to buy the whole animal. And so from a practical perspective, that was one of the reasons. But of course...
It was a little more intentional than that, though, I would say.
Well, I was going to go into the fact that it wasn't totally random.
Well, you're saying that it was not just convenience. Well, it was a way of guaranteeing something.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you can talk to that.
No, go on. I just wanted to make it, because when we did start with a very clear manifesto, for want of another description, which was started in the sort of 6 months in, and really we still do it exactly the same way. It's just operates on a much bigger scale now. And
it's printed in the back of
the
book.
Yeah, I had a good read of it. We'll talk about that
same,
too.
Yeah.
So that mentions that quite clearly, and that it's about the farmer being allowed to do what they need to do as well.
I think maybe one way to talk about this, because we can talk about why it is that we buy whole animals. We buy whole animals because it gives us greater accountability, it gives us greater quality control. As we said earlier today, we walked through our cool room downstairs through all the carcasses. We were looking at them all, and you can see how when the carcass is hanging there, that's often an animal we've seen on pasture, and we receive that animal whole. We can then account to the farmer for the condition of that animal. We can account for, or we can report on the way it was handled and managed when it left the farm gate to us. It gives us all of the elements of the animal. It's a great picture. It's a great snapshot of the farm in a moment in time. You know, this carcass is an expression of that farm and all of that practice. And to see it in its entirety gives you a huge amount of knowledge and information, which we can then pass on back to the farmer and onto the customer. But also from a customer's perspective, what most consumers don't realise is that what most butchers do and how the conventional market operates is that you buy the sections of an animal that you know that you have an audience for, that you can market, that you can sell. And what your consumers are asking you for as a butcher is limited inevitably by the boundaries of their own knowledge and understanding. Mm. So if all you're doing is buying sections in response to market demand, you're not extending the knowledge and understanding and options available to your customers, but you are running a very, a really good economic model in that there's less waste. But it's a very dull exchange. You don't have that direct relationship. When you buy something in a box, you really know which farm it came from. You really know how it was grown. You really don't have any detail. It's something that's been through many hands. So it's a very lifeless exchange, pardon the pun. And it's profoundly different. But most people who are buying meat in butcher's shops don't know that. They don't recognise that that's the case.
It's a tiny section of the animal that people are looking for.
That's right.
That people want to buy. It really is like when that's one of the things from seeing a whole animal, from seeing a whole carcass, you do realise it's like most chefs use this bit, like one little strip.
That's right.
And there's so many other different pieces and cuts and things that there might be only one or two of as well.
Yeah.
And they're the kind of the interesting parts to an animal all the time as well.
And the less we use it, the less we know about it.
Exactly,
and all of us, from chefs and butchers and consumers, lose skills and knowledge in that process. Mm. So then you end up with a group of consumers who don't know how to cook all those parts of that animal.
Yeah.
You know, so all of that knowledge, we're just degrading ourselves and diluting our capacity.
A lot of butchers as well. I know a butcher I've worked with briefly, he really wasn't that knowledgeable about a lot of the questions I had.
No.
And I imagine just because that's what his whole training, his whole job
that's
was,
it.
You take these parts
They
off
don't know how to do it.
Yeah, and some of those sort of questions on
very specific parts. It just, there wasn't the knowledge. I was kind of left quite disappointed from it as a chef who wanted to know everything and every little part, to not kind of get that information was quite
disheartening.
Well,
they don't need it. Exactly. They're doing is dealing with box meat, they don't need it.
How, and this is something that Simon can attest to, it's really bloody hard to put offal on the menu still. And, you know, there's plenty of parts of animals that there's still such, it's so tough to find a market for.
It's hard.
How do you guys, I mean, firstly, have you educated your audience enough for them to demand every bit? And if not, like, how do you try to get people to buy livers and kidneys and brains and everything?
I think that's changed dramatically. I mean, I think that's probably the growth in the business is, initially there was unavoidable waste. I just couldn't find homes for a lot of the cuts. But now we have a market, pretty much an audience for pretty much every part of it. So
yeah, okay. That's amazing.
We have the people that come who just buy bones, the people who come and buy broth from us, which we've made from the bones if they can't do that, people who only buy organ meat from us, people who only buy prime cuts from us, people who, you know, and you need all those people, you know, in hopefully the right ratios that represents the size of the animal. But we don't have many people that just come in wanting eye fillet. They're self-selecting, I suppose, to some extent. So they go to butcher shops where there's limitless amounts of eye fillet. They just go and crack another box open, and there's tenderloins forever.
Well, also they learn that because we only buy whole animals, and because the eye fillet is only 1.3% of the body, they learn that, you know, if they come asking for it, we probably won't have it.
Well, these days it's interesting. Actually, we've got it enough for them because we've driven so many people away that would only buy it. There's the hardcore that hang on, generally get the eye fillet that they require. So. You know, so it's worked out all right. But it has required, you know, this is where you've got to grit your teeth because it's very easy just to say, oh, well, we'll just get a couple of boxes of tenderloin and that will answer the problem. You've got to hold your line. And we have. So, you know, I would like to think that we're being rewarded for that sort of hard line approach now because we haven't changed the way we buy and sell. So, you know, in the end, this is an exchange of trust and our customers trust us.
Mm. We've worked very hard at it, though. I mean, we have spent years and years, literally years and years, standing, talking to customers every day, answering questions, encouraging, explaining, teaching, you know, what we know. I've been writing the newsletter now that we send out every week or 2 weeks for about 8-9 years. And that newsletter is full of information about the farms. It's full of, you know, stories about how you can use different cuts, why you shouldn't, explanations, you know, like it's, you know, we have been, I don't want to make us sound like, you know, I don't know. We've been pretty tireless. And we have been driven by the necessity to sell the whole animal because that's what we committed to. So it's an economic necessity as much as anything else. So there's a strong motivation to work this hard to educate and communicate. And hopefully, you know, entertain people and make it pleasurable and enjoyable for them. But there is nothing better than when a customer comes back a week later and goes, you know, I tried that thing you asked me, which I was just so scared. I just had no idea how I was going to do that. And I did what you said, and God, it was great. And all my friends and my family, they went crazy for it, you know. And you see this person who's just, you know, they're pumped up with this sense of power and knowledge and control, and they feel, you know, so much stronger for the exchange. That's what you want. You want every single person to go out and take more control over the choices that they're making. Mm. I mean, and confidence.
Education is so important with that, and that's probably where restaurants don't quite have that same maybe repeat custom or that interaction where they can actually, you know, give advice on how to cook something. Because you know, offal and different cuts, and you know, it can be quite technical. Like, it's like, and it's still hard to sell in restaurants. Like I think like lamb's brains are absolutely delicious, and my favourite bits of offal. But I'd be very, very wary
put them on a restaurant menu.
Yeah.
So
specials that have to be really fresh to get the best out of them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's that, and then obviously the preparation to them. So I mean, yeah, that education is so important for things like that, because people just you know, people don't know, like, it's not.
Well, we do things like we put offal into mince.
Yeah.
For example, and everybody loves that. Yeah. And they like, not yeah, only love it, so it because it tastes so good. That's right. But also they love the idea that this is a sort of a, you know, a guerrilla way of getting offal into people's diet. Yeah.
Sneaking the spinach put it into for the their bolognese.
Kids. Totally. Yeah. That's yeah. what yeah. they do. And so that's really popular. And that's like, so then you go to them, okay, so well, you did that. So how about we take you the next step?
Yeah.
Let's do some anti-kutchos with the heart.
10-step program, you know, treating
offal. Yeah, totally. That's it, you know.
Yeah.
So, look, it's possible.
Mm. Yeah, great.
It has to be fun, though.
Yeah.
Mm. All right, let's talk a bit about what happens on farms and some of the issues that you guys talk about in the book, because soil health and, you know, our current systems of agriculture are clearly unsustainable and are taking things away from the earth and not putting anything back in. And you spend a lot of time in the book explaining to people what the issues are and how the farmers that you deal with address these issues. So maybe Grant, do you want to tell us a bit about what the problem with soil is at the moment for people that are unaware, because it is so important?
Well, Australia is uniquely poorly placed. We have relatively small percentage of a vast country has fertile soils to begin with, because we've got very ancient soils that have been leached over millennia, which is very different to you know, the places that have benefited from recent ice ages. Mm. The Great Plains of America are the result of the melting ice caps in Canada, and it all flowed down into the central west of America, leaving, you know, hundreds of feet of topsoil, and there's only two places in Australia that I know of that have anything like that. So we have to be especially careful, and as was mentioned before about using hoofed animals are very tough on ground because they compact the ground, and if you leave them in any one place for an extended period of time, that compaction is a real issue. It's you know, the soil remaining porous is a key to being able to store water in the landscape. It also allows you to store carbon in the landscape. Well, one follows the other. If you can store carbon, you can then store water. And Australia probably had around 20% of, in its better areas, had around 20% carbon when white people first arrived in Australia. We now average around, most farms are averaging around 2%, maybe 1 to 2%. And that represents a loss of productivity as much as anything that is truly unsustainable. So, yeah, so the farmers we're working with are really focused on storing carbon in the soil as a way of increasing their fertility, but also storing water in the landscape. Full dams are misleading. They're often, what they tell you is that there's high level of compaction on the soil of the farm because of their runoff. That the runoff is filling the dam rather than being held in the landscape. We think of farms in a very sort of infantile way. We think of them as two-dimensional objects. We measure their surface area, and a farm is a three-dimensional productive unit that actually four dimensions because it operates through time. Good farmers understand that. They understand that they're orchestrating a productive unit through time, through seasons, and they're responding to the seasons. So if you're moving animals around a landscape, which is what a lot of our farmers will do, they're moving them constantly to promote grass growth and never burying the soil, which is, you know, the key sort of idea of, especially in dealing with ruminants anyway. The length of time it takes for them to come back is determined by the season onto that same area. Now, in really bad seasons, that might be a year, could even be longer. In good seasons, in spring, you know, you might be looking at 6 weeks before animals can come back onto the same patch of ground. But a smart farmer will manage that and manage a stocking density which is in coherence with the productive capacity of the soil, which changes all the time. And holistic farming principles teach farmers how to manage that and how to make really key estimates of how many, you know, days of feed they've got per head of sheep, say, or per head of cattle. It's a different story with chickens and pigs a bit because they're not ruminants, and so their inputs are being often brought in from outside the farm, and so you have to think about them in different ways. But still, their impact on the soil has to be sort of measured and understood. So pigs and chickens have a remarkably high impact on the soil because they work ground very hard. Pigs are like tractors. Anyone who's seen, and very few people have seen, pigs outside, they cultivate as they go, and so their impact is extremely large. So you have to manage them in a way that requires you moving them often, but that impact can be really beneficial. So the thing about farming is that most of the impacts are manageable. It's all about duration. So if what can be an asset if managed well turns into a liability if managed poorly.
To really sort of drive it home, can you explain what poor management looks like to give us the contrast?
Yeah, well, poor. There's a photo in our book actually, which is almost it's the example.
It's a great shot
That shows the fence line between one of the farms that we source from and his neighbour's farm, and the neighbour has essentially allowed all of the standing grass to be eaten by his cattle. Now, he would say that that's sort of smart farming because he's put the available feed into the cattle that he runs. But in terms of recovery, he is going to be so much slower. And just the preservation of the ecosystem at that time, even dead grass standing in a field has a huge role to play. It catches dew and then water runs down to the base of it, so there'll be small amounts of water collected. It provides habitat for insects, and there's also microbial exchange going on at the root level. So, as above, so below, and it's absolutely the case. So if you allow the soil to be bared like that, one, you're going to get high level of compaction. When the rain does come, and rain like we've had in the last few days, that will take that topsoil with it as soon as you get a storm, and then it goes straight into the creek, and then it's out in the oceans within days. And that is a waste of fertility that we can't afford. I think most people experienced the dust storms, people who lived in Sydney or the east coast of Australia anyway last summer, would have experienced what they call the dust storms that came from the inland. And that, that should have been our agriculture minister and our environment minister making a joint statement saying that this is a national disaster, because basically we were losing millions of tons of topsoil every single day. But instead, it's like a dust storm and it's an inconvenience. It means you've got to wash your car.
Yeah.
I mean, really, we are so far back in the understanding of what it's going to take to be able to feed people equitably and to feed people on a fertility base that is sustainable. At the moment, we farm with the idea of acceptable loss, which means that you've got a declining fertility constantly. In Australia's case, we are now at the point where there's no such thing as acceptable loss. If you've got 100 foot of topsoil, even that is questionable. I mean, how many years are you going to keep coughing up an inch a year? It won't take you that long before you stop farming in that spot. And that's the history of Western agriculture, unfortunately. Mm. There's been three or four cultures that we know of that have managed to farm in the same spot for more than 1,000 years. One in the Amazon, where they use charcoal, basically biochar, and grew soil, because as everyone knows, the tropics are high level of rainfall, but highly leached soils, actually not very fertile at all. So they built the fertility through constant additions of charcoal. And that allowed them to have sedentary populations really quite close to each other, and most environments, it finishes up in wars, either over water or over food. When we drive around Australia and visit farms, it's so stark, the difference between land management practice. So most farmers will talk about what they get off a farm. Very few talk about what they put into a farm to attain that output. Any business, whether it's a farm or any other business, is an equation between input and output. And most farms don't adequately measure their input or run on a much too high input level, which means that the risk level is enormous. They're 90% input to make 10%, but if the season goes bad, that is an enormous loss. So our farmers, or I call them our farmers, it's patronising, the farmers we work with understand that if they can reduce their input costs and increase or maintain or increase their outputs, then they're well on the way to having a viable farm, even through bad seasons. Mm. And that has to be a definition of sustainability that we can all work with. It's a very loose term, sustainability, but if you can't boil it down to something like that, then you know, it's, you know, everyone's working with sustainable produce apparently, but you know, what's the definition of that?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Laura, the next sort of step, and something that definitely comes into a conversation about the ethical omnivore or people's choice in the way that they consume food, is a conversation around the place of animals in a sustainable food system, and not only sustainable but in a regenerative food system that hopes to put stuff back into the places that you're talking about, Grant, that have been stripped of nutrients and carbon and the ability to retain water and things like that. Do you want to talk a little bit about what regenerative agriculture means in the place of animals in that? And then maybe we'll try to sort of talk about how conscious meat consumption sort of fits into that picture.
Oh yes, the elephant in the room.
Yes.
It always comes back to that. It's about cost and it's about whether or not we should be doing it. I think, you know, Grant's alluded to it. It's about balance and management. So, you know, you're absolutely right when you said before that hooved animals do cause, you know, potentially can cause terrible damage, especially in very delicate soils like we have, or landscapes like we have, but really it's about management. I mean, animals in landscapes can be enormously enormously useful and beneficial in adding fertility and vitality to soil and to ecosystems. As Grant's always pointing out, animals are the best cyclers of nutrient. You know, you can use other forms of putting nutrient into soil, but they often take a lot longer. Animals can cycle something overnight, you know, and add benefit to the soil. So there's a really significant argument in support of animal agriculture as almost as a tool to add vitality and fertility to soils if done properly. It's all about balance and it's all about management, and it's all about understanding that the system that we have, you know, that we largely rely on now from which we source our food, prioritises scale and speed. And the unfortunately, what happens is that when you focus on a narrow palette of breeds which grow incredibly quickly under really specific conditions that are very intensive, the price you pay, or the price we collectively pay as a community for that, is very, very high, and that's what's unsustainable. So I think, you know, I don't agree that it's impossible to grow animals for food, and that animals in livestock agriculture doesn't have a place. I think it does have a place. We have seen many examples and instances in the farms we work with where landscapes have been significantly improved by this, and not just in Australia, all over the world. So I think, the idea of a mixed farm is one that we need to focus on. The idea of monocultures, whether you're talking about plants or animals, is inherently unsustainable, and that's something that we need to move away from. You know, this focus on growing one thing, you know, at large scale,
which is
really problematic.
Goes for animals and plants as well, I think.
Well, absolutely, that's right.
It's the same thing. I think that was very fascinating listening to that. I was kind of just sitting back, and I think just want to go back to saying how a farm is kind of a four-dimensional thing, and time being so important. I think that's, people have a weird concept of time and of how long these bad practices have been going on, because it's a very short space of time in the scheme of things. Yeah, well, and I mean, even just from the you know, time humans have been farming, it's in the, you know, the scale of farming is very recent.
It's post Second World War, yeah, really, so with industrialization,
50, 60, 70 years.
That's
so
right.
That damage we've been doing is a recent thing as well. So I think of a lot of people who are against meat, they're generally against that large scale and that damage that it's doing, and we should be able to reverse it if we take steps now. But like, yeah, time is a very interesting thing, and especially with Australia as well, with the amount of time we've had these sort of European animals, and like you're saying, how the soil is different here and how we should be even more careful about soil management. I think that's kind of a fact that is lost on a lot of people, is that concept of time.
Duration is, and the gap between things is the great organizer. You know, it's what gives sense to music. It's what gives sense to farming. It's when you have continuous activity that there's no sense because there's no pause, there's no break, which sort of speaks to the other thing about abundance. And you know, I thought it was really interesting with the fires how the veneer of abundance was stripped very quickly. You know, we only needed a fire to block the Prince's Highway and every supermarket on the south coast sort of ran out of food.
It is an illusion
and it's one that will continue if we continue to subscribe to it, will not allow us to make the choices that we need to make about the way we feed ourselves. And you know, there is sort of no more important decision really about how you store water and how you feed the population, and shelter them. They're the sort of three basics of survival, and the world is essentially organized around them. Because it's so ordinary in that we eat three times a day, or those privileged enough to be able to eat three times a day. We can have, which goes back to Laura's point, we can make a really powerful decision every time we eat. So we actually have the power to change things. We can support farmers who are creating change. And the message of hope is that landscapes respond extremely quickly to different management practices. Just as it's taken one of our farmers that we work with, who you mentioned, Moorlands, he's a sixth generation farmer, and there's not too many more than six generations in Australia of continuous family ownership. He inherited a farm that had been, let's face it, really badly farmed for five generations, and he could see that. He could see the damage.
It was
caused.
Farmed with European farming methods in a landscape.
He's farming European animals, but he's farming in a way is completely
but his
antithetical to the way they approached it. So their farming was a farming of loss and overstocking and inadequate rotation of animals, of erosion of what I mean, just the full litany of disaster really about the way we farm, which they're on the Lachlan River and the Upper Lachlan, which used to be known as the Fish River for very good reason, is now a silted up sort of a silt, like all of our rivers, is highly silted and no longer is a habitat for endangered fish, which is one of the things that he's engaged in trying to preserve the southern pygmy perch, but as an allied activity to his farming practice. It's very interesting visiting a farm like that because you see the return of biology, essentially, and it starts from the ground up, because once the bacteria and the microbes are in the soil and they're exchanging with fungus, everything just builds on top of that. The insects return, the birds return to eat the insects, you know, and on and on. He's taken about 20% of his arable land out of production, yet he produces more sheep now than he used to before. Most people find that a very hard thing to get their head around. How do you actually reduce your... And it comes back to surface area
area.
Yeah, absolutely. So his depth of production...
And ideas of value too.
Is way more. But in absolute terms, he's increased his output while reducing the area of land that he farms. And people need to get their head around that paradox to then understand why we're farming badly. And the colonial impulse to just take the next farm and expand your surface area is not going to serve you. It won't serve you very well if you're taking the same practice to that extended surface area. All that will happen is that you will put off the day where you can no longer service your debt another 10 years because your scale will protect you for 10 years, which is in the bank's interest, but certainly isn't in our interest as a nation.
And as Grant says, you know, if the seasons are good, you're fine. But when the seasons aren't, and what's happening now, all of the farmers we work with report to us, is what's happening now is that the seasons are more predictably bad. And so therefore, you know, it's now a matter of urgency to change farming practices, because the systems that we've relied on for the last couple of hundred years really won't work anymore. They just won't work anymore.
Do you think we are nearing or at a tipping point?
That depends entirely on whether or not we've got the we as a community are prepared to understand that this isn't a problem which is a farmer's problem, and it's not necessarily even a consumer's problem, it's a community problem.
Yeah.
This is a problem we must solve together. And one of the things that is that must happen is that we need, just as the farmers we work with manage their farms holistically, we need holistic solutions to these problems, which bring in water policy, energy policy, soil policy, you know, health, you know, like all of these things. We need to understand that these problems must be solved with representatives from all of those different decision-making bodies in the room at the table together. We will not solve these problems separately. Mm. And we have a siloed approach to solving these problems. I care about animal welfare. I care about the environment. I care about energy. I care, you know, actually, it's all one and the same thing. Mm. And that's how we need to start thinking about these things. So when you say, can you grow animals in agriculture, and is that right or proper or ethical, or is it sustainable? My response is, well, growing animals is just one part of this conversation. These issues apply just as much as to crops and to legumes, and they apply just as much to, you know, the policy of water management, and, you know, we need a radically different approach.
It's interesting, isn't it, when, you know, I mean, I'm not gonna trash veganism or anything, but the you know, people being against meat consumption can be so vehement in their approach, where,
well, then they go and they drink almond milk.
Well, you could drink almond milk, or you could just not buy organic, or you could buy imported vegetables and things like that, or legumes, and then that's apparently a solution. When,
that's right.
Yeah, like, I mean, and like you say, there's a lot more pieces to the puzzle than just whether or not you eat meat.
It's not the what, it's the how.
It's extremism. It's the people who think we should abolish all meat haven't got a solution to how we feed.
Which isn't to say we shouldn't eat a bit less meat.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And it's a middle ground, which makes more sense. It's better farming practices, eating less meat, having a more varied diet. You know.
And you will pay more for it when you purchase the meat, but that's, you'll pay less for it as a society in environmental damage and in health issues. So it just depends when you want to cough it up, really.
Through taxes or through at the counter.
So the costs are often socialised and the profits are privatised, and I think we should need to really sort of rethink that idea.
Mm. Yeah.
It's very hard to talk about money and food, though. I mean, it's really difficult, because it's very easy for someone like me to sit at this table and say, oh, well, you know, you should be buying this kind of food because it's better for the world and better for you and so on. But, you know,
how do you sell that to someone who's living under the poverty line?
Totally, that's right.
Well, that's
exactly,
right. Or just don't have either the skill or the opportunity to cook.
Yeah.
Most people in Australia, not all, but certainly most people in Australia, though, aren't in that position.
Mm.
And, you know, Laura was talking before about the sort of reward we get when somebody goes away and cooks something. Now, that might be, I was thinking immediately of goat brisket, you know, which is not a glamorous cut. We're talking $22 a kilo. Mm. Off the bone, so you're going to feed five people with that comfortably. We're down to $4 a serve of a really high A-class protein. That's within most people's budget. That's the cost of a coffee for each person you're going to feed, and you'll probably have something left over as well.
Yeah,
that is cheap.
How
do you make it cheaper? Yeah. I mean, that is really cheap.
I guess there's a knock-on effect of the people who can afford it. If they start eating more parts of the meat, then that means you can bring the cost down because people are getting more money out of, you know, per animal. I guess that would kind of have a knockdown if everyone embraced that, to prices of certain cuts coming down, making it more available.
I think there's a, you know, like, the, I'm not a supermarket basher by any means, but I really have problems with... Yeah. Okay. I just think that
I'm not either. Like, they serve just, their purpose for
well
people.
They do, and 90% of people buy through supermarkets. Mm. And if you go to any country town,
it
will be
thing.
Basically
yeah, yeah,
be the only
it.
Place that you can access food.
That's right.
Fresh food. There may be a butcher, there may be a fruit and vegetable shop, but unlikely. Most country towns don't have those anymore. So for most suburban dwellers, that's the same as well. So a huge number of people are accessing their food through supermarkets. My issue with supermarkets is the, you know, down, the prices are coming down all the time. Now, who's that at that's at the expense of the producer. That's at the expense of the animals. That's at the expense of
us,
the environment.
Our health.
And effectively us. Yeah. So you don't that's see a really damaging idea that you're going to pay less and less for more and more. Mm. And if we've got that idea, I think, you know, we won't be able to advance the conversation in the way that we've been talking about today.
You don't see the supermarket's profits go down when they have these campaigns.
So no,
you don't.
That shows you straight away who's taking the hit.
The supermarket also needs to understand that, you know, there's a clock ticking. The supermarket might be making profits now, but as all of these ways of measuring community health start to impact, you know, we collectively go down, you know, in the supermarket with us. So I think we require a much more, you know, we need to think much more long term about the solutions for these problems.
Okay. I'm conscious of time, so Stefan's let's start wrapping it up. That's fine. No, we just try to keep to an hour, but let's finish on the book. You've got this beautiful book, The Ethical Omnivore. Maybe, Laura, just tell us a bit about, number one, how did you come to write a book, and what was the process like?
How to answer that question? So, as I think I said before, one of the things that we've been doing for a long time is writing a weekly or fortnightly newsletter. Over the course of a long period of time, we have a pretty loyal readership for that newsletter. And it allowed us to conduct a conversation with people who are interested in the same sorts of issues as us. Not just people who are buying food from us, but also people who have common interests in all sorts of different places. And that conversation is immensely rewarding and enjoyable. At the same time as conducting that conversation, in an effort to promote the farmers we work with, to tell their stories and to educate people, pass on the knowledge that we were lucky enough to be gaining along the way, every day we are answering questions from our customers. You know, where does my meat come from? How is it grown? How did it die? How should I cook it? Should I even eat it at all? All of these questions we're just constantly finding ourselves answering. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we could put that knowledge into something that people could have as a sort of a handbook? Mm-hmm. Just what we've... It's just our voice. It's just our perspective, our perception. And so I wanted to do this for a long time. But it took a long time to actually get to the point where we could do it because, you know, you've got a family, excellent, you're running a business, and writing a book is, as I discovered, it's not the same as writing a newsletter.
For sure.
So we were lucky.
You're just grimacing there, Steph. It's like giving you PTSD of your last book, maybe.
We had we were lucky because we had a conversation with Murdoch, and they came to the party pretty quickly. So having a contract was nice.
Helps.
Yeah, that's right. It was very interesting though in the process because we had thought we very much wanted to answer the questions that we were asked in the butchery. We didn't think we wanted to write a recipe book, but the publisher said this is something you should do
because they sell.
And we understood the rationale for that. That made a lot of sense. We wanted people to... We understood that meat is a tricky subject to start off with, and we also understood that people need some practical tools and few recipes that help them work out how to approach some of these unusual cuts is a good thing. And we also understood the logic behind giving them... It's almost like a Trojan horse, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's great.
What we also realised, initially when the publisher said, you know, you should have recipes in this book, we really balked because we didn't know quite how we'd do it. But after a while, we realised the answer was obvious.
Yeah, tell us.
The book is about community. It's about the community of creatures and organisms in the soil. It's about the communities of insects that engage with the plant, you know, that live above the surface of the soil and in the ecosystem. It's about the animals. It's about the farmers. It's about the people. It's about the people who cook the food. It's all of these interconnected communities. And along the way, what we've learned is that, I can't remember who said it, but it's that idea that if you tug on one part of the universe, you know, it changes the shape of the universe in another part. Everything is interconnected and everything impacts on everything else. And the more you understand that idea, the more profoundly that affects the way you think about things. And so the idea of interconnected communities and the absolute critical importance of healthy, vibrant communities is really at the heart of the book. And so one of the things that we've also become aware of over the years is the fact that we have our own community, almost sort of in the same way that starting the business wasn't, you know, a clear sort of plan. I think we've also recognised over time that we are part of a wonderful, wonderful community of people, of customers and activists and farmers and people who have common interests and passions. And so the obvious thing was to say to our community, you give us the recipes, you know, you put your recipes
great
in.
Way
how
to
do
it.
You, what do you do?
It makes it so beautiful and personalised. And
so
it
every
really
recipe
brings
has
it all
a story,
together. Yeah,
you know,
it's fantastic.
The person who did it. So
I
that was
it.
A... And that gives us an awful lot of pleasure because these people are fascinating. Mm. We find our customers just as interesting as the farmers we work with. They've all got these incredible stories. You know, how did they come to be thinking this way about food?
And they're buying the whole animal from you as well. They've got
it's great.
Over time.
Over time.
Over
time.
Well, it's been a great exercise really because it's you know, there are people who have grown up with us, and there are children who are now adults who say, "Oh yes, I used to come down to the butcher shop when I was 4 years old, and now I cook for myself." And so it's sort of been part of their life, and that's really sort of special.
It makes
in
us
a
sound
way.
Really old.
Well, it's just that they're young, and 14
true.
Years is a long
yeah.
time for them.
We've seen people have babies and grow families.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's been really good. But a lot of the producers that we work with, we've worked with for 12 years as well. So we've gone through the changes in their lives as much as anything. One particular producer, you know, has had his whole farm was burnt out in the Sir Ivan Doherty fires from 4 years ago, plus then 3 years of horrendous drought on top of that, and still he missed only two deliveries in all of that time.
Wow.
Some of the best beef that we saw. So that to me says a lot about the way he farms and the benefits that you get from the right genetics in the right place managed the right way. So it's you know, that's what we should be striving for.
We feel very lucky, you know, like incredibly lucky. We have access to and we have relationships with people who we consider to be incredibly thoughtful and inventive and creative and interesting, and I mean, you know, it's an enormously gratifying, wonderful experience. And the book gave us an opportunity to just pull some of that together. And it's like any of these things, it's a moment in time. We hope that it's a useful tool for people and that they are as inspired as we are by the farmers, the stories of the farmers we work with. Because, you know, really the most important thing is that people feel overwhelmed by how on earth to navigate this minefield of food.
That's tough.
And so what we wanted to do with this book is to say, not only here are some suggestions for how the sorts of questions you should be asking the people who sell you your food and some suggestions for how you should be thinking about these things, but also there is a real message of hope here, and that is, as Grant said before, these landscapes can be transformed relatively quickly, but it takes will and it takes all of our will. We all have to work together and we all have to pull in the same direction. Every little step everybody makes in the right direction is you know, something to be celebrated, and everybody deserves a pat on the back. We're not all perfect. We all fuck up, you know. But every little step in the right direction towards endorsing and supporting better food production systems is going to benefit all of us in the long term. So, and there's lots of opportunity. It's exciting.
Yep. It's fantastic, and it's a beautiful book.
Thank you,
everyone
very
out
much.
There. Go get one. To finish off, how can people get the book, and how can people find Feather and Bone?
Just probably through the website's the easiest way, and we're based in Marrickville in Sydney, but we also deliver all over Sydney and a bit further afield as well. The book is available from the normal
big retail chains where you can buy it directly from us, or small regional bookshops like Better Read Than Dead just up the road is stocking it.
Support your independence.
There's, depending where you're accessing it from, there's many ways to access it. It's not hard to find if you want it.
Perfect.
Just don't confuse us with Feather and Bone in Hong Kong, which bears no connection to us whatsoever, but you might find if you Google Feather and Bone, you get them instead of us.
Oh, well. Well, it's a great book. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's only a week after launch. It's beautiful. And I think this is exactly what people need. I work in a world where people think about the sustainability of their food consumption. And like you say, it's a minefield trying to navigate it. So a beautifully presented modern book that not only sort of gives you great recipes and talks about community, but acts as that succinct handbook and tells the stories of the farmers and things like that is perfect. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today.
No worries. We'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.